Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Jason Martell as we talk about that extra planet and some other great things right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Welcome back with Jason Martell and your phone calls as well. Kind of rhymes, Jason, doesn't it?
Yes.
So what have you been personally working on lately?
Well, you know, the basic answer there, George, is looking at various ancient sites to date them, hopefully more accurately. A lot of these ancient sites that are, some of them quite well known, like Giza would be a good example, could possibly be older than we attribute to modern academic understanding. And the reason why is what we're doing is a new technique using two realms of research. One is astronomical markers, but then also geological markers. So sites like Giza are a great example, because if you look at Egypt's past, there speaks of a time when the pharaohs were able to walk down the causeway of the Great Pyramid and literally be right at the foot of the Nile, step aboard a ship and, you know, take a cruise. If we look today on Google Maps at Giza and see that the Nile is several miles away now from the actual pyramids, that's geological evidence that we can track how long it's taken for the Nile that was once going right along the edge of the pyramid, how far it's meandered miles away and how long of a geological process that's taken. And so other sites that we can look at too, like Lake Titicaca, we can see sites like Machu Picchu and Cusco and other of these sites that are well known for having artifacts and some thriving, possibly technological civilization at one point. If we look at Lake Titicaca today, we can see, again on Google Maps, that there's been a great amount of like geological change where the waters have receded, so that at one point these cities, Machu Picchu and Cusco, could have been right on the edge of a waterway.
That's right.
And what's really interesting about that, George, is that some of this data extends off planet, meaning if we were a technological planet at some point in our past, let's say in the last golden age, and this is possibly when we built a lot of the structures here on Earth, we might have also built some of them off Earth. And this seems to fall in alignment with what we have at Cydonia, this area on Mars where there's a face and pyramids. Now, while Cydonia might have been built much, much earlier, possibly, let's say, hundreds of thousands of years ago, when Mars had a different north and south pole, meaning the poles shift, and at one point, Cydonia would have literally been right on the equator so that the face could have been seen as it was just doing its orbit, kind of like a marker. But what we see at Cydonia is also some of these similarities with Giza and sites like Machu Picchu being close to Lake Titicaca. It appears that whoever built Cydonia did it right on the edge of an ancient shoreline. Everyone loves to live on a waterfront property, whether it be over a lake or an ocean. And not only that doesn't extend to our modern understandings of real estate, but we see this going well into the past, also even off planet at Cydonia.
Did you find that the ancients might have had the ability to use electricity? Because did we not find some things that might have pointed in that direction?
We did, George. There's some overriding theories with ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics as to how they were carved, or some of the wall reliefs as you get into some of these deep recesses of tombs and crypts. Modern archaeologists would support the idea that they use electricity for electroplating jewelry, but no actual use of, let's say, for powering a light bulb. But what we see in Egypt, in one specific area called Dendera, is wall reliefs of what appear to be Egyptians holding up light bulbs, literally plugged into some type of an energy device. And why this might sound amazing is it supports the idea that when you go into a lot of these deep tombs and crypts, there's no evidence of soot anywhere on the ceiling, meaning they had no use of flame for hours and hours to light the room while they carved these intricate wall reliefs. The only other theory was that they were using copper mirrors to reflect the light, and that just doesn't hold up as you get down to two or three turns. So an alternative theory is exactly what they were depicting in Dendera, Egypt. And anyone can just you can Google Dendera light bulb and see the evidence for yourself. But the Dendera bulb is a large light bulb. Now, Egyptologists would tell you that he's holding up the lotus flower, and the bulb that you see with the snake in the middle coming out, that bulbous mass is the aroma of the lotus flower. Okay, that's fine. To me, it looks like a light bulb. And you can see that it's even plugged into some type of a large energy device.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly it's some device used for some purpose. There's no doubt about that.
Right. And the reason why this is an interesting topic for me is that the Dendera light bulb, electricity in ancient Egypt, is a small opening of a door or a small page being turned into a much larger book that shows that, yes, on a small level, they were using electricity. However, there appears to have been a much larger interest in a form of technology that today we would call it a subtle energy. We don't quite understand what they were harnessing or how they were doing it, but it appears that Giza was part of something of a world energy grid, where somehow the Giza pyramid, the Great Pyramid, was not a tomb, was some type of large reactor. And what we see are steps of technology, George. So in my latest research, looking into the Ark of the Covenant possibly being some type of a large battery that powers the pyramid, it literally fits right in what we would call the sarcophagus. But there are precursors to that, meaning the light bulb is possibly a great starting point to understand that the Egyptians, well, if they were using light bulbs, how did they power it? And so we found evidence of what now is called the Baghdad battery, which of course you're very familiar with.
Sure.
And found about a dozen of those in Iraq. But all over Egypt, George, in that same time frame, 2500 BC, all over Egypt, we see a similar depiction of not a Baghdad battery, but a much larger version of the battery. Instead of it being 6 inches tall, some of these vases or jars appear to be 6 feet tall. And this possibly could have been another form of a way to store up these electrons, these positive electrons, and to have stored up energy. So there is evidence all over Egypt for this ancient use of what appears to be electricity.
All right, let's take some calls here for you, Jason, as they begin to line up. John is truck driving in Illinois to get us started. Go ahead, John.
Good morning, George. Jason.
Morning.
I call on the wild card line because this is going to be a true wild card question.
Alrighty.
Nice.
Okay, Jason, I'm with you on this. I don't think this is Nibiru that they found, this large gravity well. And I got to thinking about models I've seen as far as the sun orbiting our galaxy. It's in like a loop-de-loop kind of pattern. And then I got thinking about our poles, the North and South Pole flip every once in a while. Instead of a large star or a planet orbiting us, what is the possibility that our sun is actually orbiting a miniature black hole? And if so, I mean, could it be possible that something that massive could also be pulling in like Alpha Centauri orbiting it as well? Could we be like this huge, massive, complex system orbiting this black hole?
Well, that's an interesting theory. The black hole would definitely be a very large source of gravity. I don't have enough data to say whether or not that would be a possibility of an option. But what's interesting that you bring up is that the sun is definitely moving through space. And this is something that a lot of people don't understand, meaning if it's in orbit around something else, whether it be a gravity well or more likely another failed sun, a dark star, that changes the idea that we're a static solar system. Most people would think that the sun is static, and that our planets are simply in motion around the sun. That's not the case, folks. Our sun, if we are in a binary orbit, our sun is moving through space in an orbit around another sun. And that changes the whole idea for why we even have something called the precession of the equinox, which all the ancients tracked. We're not static, we are moving through space. And this is why we have a change of perspective. And we go through different ages, about every 2,000 years, our North Pole aligns to a new star. And so this is a whole new way of looking at our solar system, and even the model for a planet X, is to understand that this is a binary orbit and we're constantly in motion.
It's a good point. Now, this binary system that could be out there, how close is that other star, to our sun?
Well, it's billions of miles beyond Pluto. We don't really know that answer just yet. There are some likely candidates, George. The closest one, which seems to be in alignment with a gentleman I mentioned earlier, Walter Cruttendon, would be Cirrus A and B. The system Cirrus A and B, which is twin suns, do seem to have planets around their two suns that could possibly support life. And a lot of the ancient cultures point towards either Orion or Cirrus A and B. Some of these cultures, like the Dogon tribe, they had knowledge of Cirrus A and B, and they're to this day cut off from civilization and technology. Yet NASA and technologists would confirm that the Dogon's descriptions and information of Orion, and as well as Cirrus being in an orbit around each other, they're dumbfounded as to how they know this. So Cirrus A and B, while it's two stars kind of in its own little mini binary, grouped together as a star system, Cirrus A and B, it is a likely candidate for being that second sun. Otherwise, George, there's, you know, just something we have yet to find that's just so far out there. You know, what's interesting, too, is that there's an Encyclopedia Britannica that's like from the 1980s, and it was a technology edition, and it has a diagram of Pioneer 1 going into the depths of the solar system. In 1983, it shows this in an encyclopedia, and it shows the Pioneer 1 passing a 10th planet and a second sun.
Isn't that amazing?
It is, and you wonder, why is this kind of just a theory that's only brought up now and then? Well, it seems to have been holding its weight, holding its traction, so that even today we're still looking for that missing mass, which today we call that Planet X, or hopefully an ancient Nibiru.
Let's go to Norm in Ottawa. That's in Canada, folks. Welcome to the show, Norm. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I had a question. The Planet X you're speaking of, how many light years is it away? And my comment is it possible that this planet doesn't even exist anymore because it's so far?
Both are valid points, meaning one, how far is it from us? We don't have an answer yet because we haven't been able to identify the planet's exact orbit.
And unlike a star, which burns out and you can still see the light, even though it may have burned out, you know, billions of years ago, in this particular case, the physical planet, they sense, they see it out there, they feel it out there with their calculations, right?
That's correct. All the evidence points to it being there. Now, does it still exist? Could it have been there and we're seeing the remnant influences? Possibly. There are a lot of theories that have been put forth that would suggest the idea that, you know, we've had some type of great collision in the past, or that there's been some, you know, great splattering of debris, making the idea that there was some type of exploded planet. And there was a gentleman, Dr. Thomas Van Flandern, great gentleman that passed away, unfortunately.
Yeah, he was great.
He was a good guy, right? And he had that theory, right, the exploded planet hypothesis. You know, we did a few debates around that, and being that he was, you know, much more educated in math than I was, I respected Dr. Flandern's views, and it's still something to consider that maybe Nibiru no longer exists, but I think there's enough current evidence to suggest that it probably does still exist.
All right, we have time for a couple more calls, then the break, and then back with more. George in St. Louis. Hey, George.
Good morning, Jason. Morning, George.
Hi.
There are some models of a solar system where the material coalesces and it forms planets. That's not the model that that formed our solar system. The theory is that we do have a double star system. That second star pulled material, like you pulled taffy, and formed the gas giants. The gas giants being in the outer orbits is unusual for a solar system. Every exoplanet we've ever discovered had the huge gas planets on the inner portions of the solar system. unlike ours. We're exceptionally different, and that second star probably does exist. Also, the three inner planets are rocky planets. You know, Earth,
firmament,
you know,
yes.
Venus. Yeah, and it's unlike the material on the gas planets and on the outer orbits, which means probably we're more characteristic of that unknown star, that second star that's in our orbits. So we are very unusual for a solar system.
You bring up some really great points, sir. The Sumerian epic of creation actually explains a lot of the orbital anomalies for our solar system, but possibly why we also had the seeding of life, this panspermian, or this great evolution of life that they can't explain. And it seems to have stemmed, at least following the epic of creation, which is ancient Nibiru, its main moon, when it whacked our primitive Earth, there was the mingling of waters. Nibiru being much more evolved of a planet for its duration of time and existence, and its moon Kingu, it might have also have had much more chances to evolve or have natural life already flourishing on it, being that it's next to a technological planet. So when Kingu whacked our primitive Earth, the mingling of the waters, as the Bible talks about and the Sumerians say, is a basic understanding for how we got that kickstart of life going. And it also explains a lot of the reasons why, you know, if you look at Earth in its whole, remove the water, there's this large gaping hole, meaning at one point Earth was just Pangaea. It was one landmass, and if you siphon off all the water, it's just half a planet. Where's that missing chunk of land? It's all explained by this other missing planet and its interactions with us in the past.
Jason, do you think we're ever going to find out for sure what's going on out there?
You know, I try and be optimistic and hopeful, George, saying this with a smile on my face, that something will happen in our lifetime to answer these questions. But, you know, I feel like I'm kind of grasping at straws, honestly. If something's going to happen, it's going to happen. You know, we live such a short lifespan. This research that I'm looking into with this lost cycle of time and how the ancients tracked precession, 24,000-year cycle, modern astronomy would call precession 26,000 years. I'd say more 24,000 years because they're not considering a binary orbit. But the point is, all the ancient cultures track this 24,000-year cycle, and we only live 100 years. So, you know, there's the model or the idea of a mayfly, you know, this little insect that only lives 24 hours. Its whole lifespan is one day. So if a mayfly is born on a cloudy, you know, no sun, a cloudy day, and there's no wind.
That's what they get.
Another mayfly comes up, and he's like, you know, I've heard of this stuff called wind or sunshine, and I don't see it. It probably just doesn't exist. And they both die and never see it. So just because we only live 100 years, that doesn't mean that there isn't this much larger scenario playing out around us that we're just now becoming aware of, George. So I would be, again, hopeful and optimistic that something's going to happen. But I'm very confident that in our lifetime, we're going to continue to unravel this mystery. It seems very clear that there's a pace happening here that's exponentially speeding up. And all the references, when we go into the ancient times of Sumer and Egypt, Hindu, going well back beyond 3800 BC, but more like Göbekli Tepe time, 10,000 BC.
That's a long time ago, Jace. Got a great program in store for you on our next Coast to Coast show. We're going to talk for the first half about a horrible situation going on in suburban Los Angeles of a methane leak. And then we are going to be talking about some incredible stories of talking dogs. I kid you not, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Jason Martell with us, our final segment as we talk about Nibiru. What about these folks who think that everything is only 6,000 years old, Jason?
Well, you know, I mean, I was raised as a Christian, a very devout Christian, at least on my, you know, my family side. And so a lot of that information is still prevalent. And here's how I would answer that, George. And kind of interesting. You know, the age of Pisces has just ended, and we're now in the age of Aquarius. And that was a marker that kind of happened right around 2012, just as the Mayans were calculating the change of an age, not the end of time, but the end of an age, the end of an epoch of time. And so calculating that, it's interesting that the age of Pisces is the symbol of a fish, which seems to be also synonymous with what you see on the back of all the cars and vehicles that are people who are into, you know, Jesus and follow Christ, sometimes put the symbol of a fish on their car. Well, that symbol has a much more ancient knowledge meaning than just Jesus. It's the symbol of Pisces. So it's also the time of Jesus. Now, not that the age of Jesus has ended, but if you look at the crossover between the age of Pisces to the age of Aquarius, we've crossed into a new age where now things are shifting beyond what they've been for the last 2,000 years, which was more of a focus on one specific character, for the most part, Jesus Christ.
Interesting take. Final calls. You ready? Chris in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Morning, gentlemen. How y'all doing?
Good, Chris. Thank you.
Morning.
Excellent. Morning. I captured an anomaly in the sky back in October at about 5 a.m. It was coming out of the south. Moon was in, you know, opposite direction, going down toward the west. And, you know, I've kind of had an understanding of what I, you know, knowledge of Nibiru and what it meant. Anyway, it scared the bejesus out of me. I photographed it. And in fact, you can, if you go to your Facebook page, one of the last comments is me. And
okay.
Then you can click on that. And then I reposted it. And then I commented, and there's like three pictures. So you can kind of, you know, look at it for yourselves. But there are two objects in there. And one is just, you know, a barely illuminated object, kind of looks like a moon. The other one looks like a circle that is swirling on fire. And it was so bright, it illuminated the side of the house.
Well, what do you say about those, Jason, who say we're not being visited? I mean, here's another great example of something obviously there.
Right. Well, unfortunately, what we've had over the last few years of people interested in the topics of Planet X or Nibiru is they're either using, you know, ground-based cameras or even webcams and things like this of nature, and are filming things that not necessarily are another planet. And while this information seems interesting and relevant, the idea that there's something like lingering by the sun, or that there's some other planet being hidden behind the sun, unfortunately, this information just doesn't hold up over the test of time. So I think that this caller in particular might be a little bit more interested in the modern idea that there is a Planet X right near us and it's causing effects on the Earth. I unfortunately do not support this idea, because if there is anything 4 to 8 times the size of Earth and it comes anywhere near the inner part of the solar system, we're going to see it, simply because we have a global network of amateur astronomers that are always watching the sky. They're the ones that see things and escalate it to the professional community. Things like Shoemaker-Levy 9, Hale-Bopp, all of these various things that we have, it's usually an amateur astronomer that sees it first. And so something the size of Nibiru, we're going to see it. It's not going to be anything that we would miss.
Is there a predicted time when the Anunnaki from Nibiru are supposed to come back?
That's a hard question to answer. Sometimes we would want to calculate that to say, well, when was the last time Nibiru was here, and use that as a marker. I'm using a little bit of a different marker, George, which is this lost cycle of time. And that cycle is around 24,000 years. It appears that there's a correlation to when we have these visitations, and it seems to be more in alignment when we're in what we would call the golden age. So we seem to go through a rise and fall of civilizations here on Earth, which could be tied to this greater binary orbit. And there appears to be times when we're in the dark ages, and we have no knowledge of higher understandings and higher spiritual knowledge. And then there are times when we're in the golden age. And literally, ancient Hindu texts speak of a time when man is able to interpret God. We're nowhere near that now. We're about 8,000 years away from the time of the next golden age. But as you can see, I think everyone can feel, we've been exponentially growing towards something greater, a push of more knowledge.
What also fascinates me are these depictions of gods in the South American culture, where they were all dark-skinned, dark hair, small, and these gods are taller,
right.
White hair, very strange.
You bring up a great point, George. You know, that's a common theme that we see happening, is that a lot of these ancient cultures seem to reference gods that aren't indigenous to the region, meaning all over South America, as you stated, these Quetzalcoatl and Kukulcan, they're always depicted, these South American gods, not as small, dark-skinned, dark-haired. They're larger beings and have pale skin, red hair, sometimes white hair. And in other cultures, too, like in Australia, we have cultures, these Aboriginal tribes in Australia that go back 60,000 years, and they have petroglyphs that have literally been dated to 12,000 years, and their depictions of the Wangina basically look like the modern-day gray alien, and they have stories upon stories about these Wangina coming out of the Blue Mountains. And even to this day in Australia, the Blue Mountain Range is, you know, synonymous with UFO sightings and abductions and such. So there's definitely a theme that is happening where we can see that even well into the past, there are these recorded stories of interactions with beings that seem to come down from the skies. So today we're kind of scanning the skies once again, looking for those beings and whether or not we're going to see them. My answer, George, is it seems that we have the interaction with these cultures when we're in our higher ages, when we're a little bit more, I think, able to reach out from our side and have an intelligent conversation with a higher culture, where today I think we're still grappling with a lot of the things of our own natural resources and war. So I'm not sure how higher cultures would still look at us and whether or not they're ready to once again have open contact with us.
Darwin, where did he miss the missing link?
Well, Darwin looked at different ways of evolution through macro and microevolution. He definitely saw that a fish swimming up a stream over decades could develop a new fin and a microevolution and make it swim faster. But there was no macroevolution, no jumping of species. And when he looked at the human evolution, he could clearly see that the anthropological bone record had some literally missing links, meaning you look at the hominid that was here naturally that developed just biologically without any influence, let's just call it the Bigfoot that was evolving naturally here on Earth. And then there seems to be us, where there's an offshoot of this Neanderthal that they just cannot explain genetically how we have similar features, but we're so far departed from the Neanderthal that there had to have been some type of genetic intervention or some type of missing piece of the story that they haven't been able to uncover. And as we look at the genome today and look at things to understand from a genetic perspective where we come from, it turns out that it's right in alignment with the Sumerian Epic of Creation, which states from Sitchin's translation, the Anunnaki essentially showed up around 300,000 years ago in southern Africa and first started doing this mining of the gold and created the first Lulu-Amelu, the first Adamu, as the Hebrews called it, Adam in the Bible. They created the first worker, this primitive worker, to mine the gold. So it's a very interesting tale when we look at the understanding that, from genetically speaking, modern science says that the mitochondrial DNA for a human that shows up that looks like us today shows up in southern Africa around 300,000 years ago.
Okay, next up we go to Andy in Phoenix. Andy, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Hello, George.
Hi, Andy.
Yeah, hi. I'm a big fan. I've been listening to you for over a decade.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I have all the Ancient Aliens episodes.
Then you've got many with Jason in there then.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm asking your guests, does he think that Yeshua was an Anunnaki?
Aha. Was Jesus part of the Anunnaki, Jason?
Well, you know, I really couldn't answer that question, but what is an interesting point of view to take on that question is this. If Jesus was an Anunnaki,
you know, the Anunnaki lived on a planet which had a 3,600-year orbit around the sun. So that's still one solar year for them, but it's 3,600 years on Nibiru, meaning for us, one loop around the sun is a year. On Nibiru, one loop around the sun is 3,600 years. So a lot of these stories talk about how to get the longevity of the gods, if you were to go to Nibiru, you would have that extended life. So let's just say Jesus was from Nibiru, hypothetically speaking, of course. If he came here and said, hey, I'm here, my people, I'm going to return, and he leaves for 1 year, just 1 year to him, he pops back on Nibiru, 1 year goes by for him, it's been 3,600 years here on Earth. So, yeah, there's some interesting parallels with looking at the dynamics of being able to have an extended lifespan and the longevity. A lot of these great characters that come out of our biblical cultures that seem to have this gift of an extended lifespan.
Now, you've talked a little bit about Mars. What do you think is on Mars in terms of current life?
Probably a great abundance, George. You know, there appears to be a release of information happening where, you know, just recently with the movie The Martian and then some coordinated press releases that says, hey, all the precursors for life are here. It's great. But they've been saying that for quite a while. And there appears to be, if anyone scours through the NASA archives, which as a college student, I spent dubious amounts of time rather than studying, looking through the Malin Space Science Systems archives, you know, online and looking at imagery that even today, from the Mars Global Surveyor to others that are still in orbit, there's a great wealth of information that shows the surface of Mars today as a living planet. In my lectures that I present at Snowfest and Conscious Life Expo, I show slides from Malin Space Science Systems and from NASA directly that show areas of Mars that have standing water, vegetation of some sort, whether it be bacterial or microbial. I mean, we can't exactly tell what it is, but there's formations of what I would say chlorophyll-based life forms around these water sources, and you can see it over and over. NASA releases most of these photographs in black and white. However, some of the other agencies, like China and most specifically ESA, the European Space Agency, release their data in color. So when we take shots of the Gusev crater by NASA, the same area from the ESA satellite shows what appears to be clear vegetation, green patches of living something.
Next up, we go to Derek now in Nebraska. Go ahead, Derek.
Hi, guys. Just wanted to say I'm a big fan. You're two of my favorite sources
for all this information.
So appreciate that.
Thank you.
I mostly just kind of wanted to comment, bring some, I don't know, correlations between like the way we're brought up. Just as people, first off, we come from women. So I've always personally thought that God or our creator, architect was like a female. Is that a possibility? Or you guys think like that? I get shunned a lot for having that type of point of view.
You shouldn't get shunned for that, my friend, because there is definitely a much more interesting perspective from the Egyptian culture's view of how we view our cultures. And in the ancient past, there was much more of a harmony between masculinity and femininity, where a lot of the men in higher Egyptian times actually wore wigs. Even in some of the courts and things that we see in colonial times, the reason why they wore those wigs was a sign from this ancient influence of knowledge of a balance, where some of these higher cultures seem to understand the balance between male and female, and there's a greater understanding of being able to utilize all of our senses, where today we kind of seem to have lost this ability to use things like our pineal gland. And a lot of these ancient cultures, the Egyptians as an example, instead of having five senses, had literally an understanding of over 300 senses, tapping into their glandular system and being able to sense and see things in someone, where if you stood before someone as an ancient Egyptian, you might be able to know or see things in them as much more insightful than we are today. Let's call it sizing someone up.
I think it's exciting just thinking about the possibilities that we've been visited, seated, and may continue to be visited, isn't it?
I think it's something that's going to continue to be an interesting topic for people who are still on the fence, either devout religious purposes or atheist purposes, for whatever that might cause them to be in that camp. But there's an overwhelming amount of evidence, George, from both the scientific sector as well as the religious sector, which I'm not going to put ancient aliens in the religious sector, but let's just say around the world, global religions point to the idea that there was higher influence in their past. And then we look today to say, well, where is that higher influence now? Is it coming? Why is it missing? And these are questions that should be answered, because I think it speaks to the climate of our current cultures and things that possibly we're going to have to face at some point with us killing each other and destroying the planet. That has to end.
It sure does. Billy in New Orleans will be our final call. Go ahead, Billy.
How are you tonight?
Good,
I wanted
Billy.
To thank you both for doing such great work, and it's a great show tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a two-part question. I wanted to know, why haven't we heard more from Eric Von Daniken? And if the Egyptians and the Sumerians had this knowledge about people from other planets, why or did it transfer to the Greeks?
Eric, of course, is alive and well. He's up in age, but he's still very active. We'll probably see him, Jason, at the Conscious Life Expo or the Contact in the Desert this year. And in terms of his second question, I've got 40 seconds for you to answer.
Well, basically, I mean, you know, we don't hear a lot from Eric Von Daniken simply because, you know, he's based out of Germany, but his research is very prevalent. And, you know, I think over time we're going to continue to see more and more of an interest in these topics. And other people are picking up the torch, Giorgio, the kind of the star of Ancient Aliens, and others that are going to continue to find more information in these topics are going to make discoveries that are going to be from angles that we don't expect.
All right, Jason, be well. I'll see you at Big Bear Lake, California, in about a week or so.
Thanks so much, George. Take care, as always.
I don't ski, but I'm going to have a good time up there, so come on out. And, you know, they've got cottages there and everything else, so that's exciting. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borrelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.